It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. On Tuesday, Representative Eric Swalwell, Democrat from California, joined us on the show to talk about the end of the Mueller report. And I asked him what Congress could do to rebuild trust in our political system.
I think what we can do to earn the faith of the people we represent is to scrub our government of dirty maps and dirty money.
Dirty maps. There, Swalwell is talking about partisan gerrymandering, and that's drawing district maps to favor one political party over another.
If people have faith that their representatives come from districts that are drawn by independent commissions who don't have a stake in the outcome, and that the outside unlimited money that pours into our elections will become transparent, I think we can reach consensus on the issues that the American people want us to reach consensus on, and I think you'll have a better, more responsive government.
And those so-called dirty maps were before the Supreme Court this week in two separate cases.
The first case in Maryland has to do with a Democratic gerrymander of the state's congressional map.
That's David Daley, author of the book Rat Why Your Vote Doesn't Count.
They're talking about one specific district, Maryland's 6th, which Democrats essentially turned inside out. It had been a district represented by a Republican for many, many years. And in the 2011 redistricting, Democrats took 170,000 voters and shipped them out of that district, shipped 170,000 new voters in, and that district elected a Democrat that year. And now Maryland has had a 7-1 congressional map ever since.
The Maryland map also went before the Supreme Court last year, but the justices dismissed the case on procedural grounds. The second case before the court this term looks at the entire congressional map for the state of North Carolina.
In North Carolina, it's the other way around. It's the Republicans who gerrymandered that state. And this has to do with the 2016 congressional map that came into play after the previous map had been declared an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. Now, the plaintiffs in this case are saying that the Republicans wrongly used partisan data in order to draw themselves a 10-3 enduring congressional majority in that state.
But this problem extends well beyond Maryland and North Carolina. Gerrymandering lawsuits are pending in at least a dozen states. And last year, The Takeaway spoke with voters in Pennsylvania about partisan gerrymandering in their state.
I look at that map and I think somebody must have been on drugs or something when they drew it. I mean, how can you logically say that makes sense?
Cindy Blair Miller has lived in Downington, Pennsylvania for almost 40 years. She's a Democrat in a district that tends to vote Republican.
Elections are supposed to be free and fair. Whether it's fair in terms that it accurately represents the population and their perspectives. And if you design a congressional map that specifically divides it up so that you focus the district on a particular party, then you're not representing the people accurately. And that doesn't seem fair.
Fairness. It's at the center of the Maryland and North Carolina gerrymandering cases before the Supreme Court this week. And David Daley told me that the makeup of the court, which has become more conservative under Trump, could have a direct effect on how congressional maps are drawn.
Anthony Kennedy, along with the four liberals on the court, had long been considered very interested in trying to find a problem to solve the most extreme partisan gerrymanders in the country. Kennedy then retires after the court punts on those two cases. He's replaced by Brett Kavanaugh, a much more conservative justice who has not in the past shown an interest in these voting rights cases. So all of a sudden, the balance of the court is much different.
Let's talk a little bit about how that new balance of the court could impact what we're hearing coming out of the court. I mean, do we have any idea how the newest justice to the court, Brett Kavanaugh, is likely to vote?
Kavanaugh and John Roberts are clearly the targets of the four liberals here. And Elena Kagan's questioning was clearly bent on trying to show Roberts and Kavanaugh that there was a way forward and that there was a manageable standard to judge the most extreme partisan gerrymanders. Roberts and Gorsuch and Kavanaugh seemed to agree that partisan gerrymandering is a serious and significant problem. But they still seem skeptical that the court has the right tools in front of them to identify and fix them. And Roberts, over time, has long been really skeptical of trying to bring the courts into judging the partisan fairness of maps that are protested by one side or the other. They don't want to invest necessarily the institutional reputation of the court for independence by picking partisan winners and losers. But I think, you know, what the folks who are bringing these cases in all of these states are saying is that there is nobody else except the courts at this point to step in and try to bring fairness, that these maps have become so gerrymandered and so warped that the very essence of democracy is at stake.
What about in the lower courts? I mean, if the Supreme Court is saying, or particularly Justice Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Roberts, you're saying they're hesitant to sort of get very specific on how gerrymandering has been executed, if you will. Have any lower courts found a solution to this?
Nobody has really found a solution. Lower courts around the country have been very interested in this, and also state the Supreme Courts have become very interested. In Pennsylvania in 2018, the state Supreme Court found the congressional map there drawn by Republicans that had given them a 13-5 advantage in a fairly blue state, and that it had locked in that advantage in a really enduring way. And they called that an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander in violation of their state constitution. And they forced a new map to be drawn. They brought in a neutral special master, a professor at Stanford, and he drew a map that in 2018 produced 9 Democrats and 9 Republicans, something fairly in line with the actual partisan breakdown of that state. So certainly it can be done. We can have fair maps. You just usually have to take them out of the hands of the politicians who have a particular self-interest in what the outcomes are.
There are basically Americans who are saying they're concerned that their vote, that they won't be able to vote, or that their vote won't be counted, if you will, or they won't be heard. So how do you take this thing that is supposed to be something that all Americans have access to, one person, one vote, and take it out of the hands of politicians who, as you said, have a deep interest in making sure that people vote one way or another?
I think that's exactly right, and that is the crux of the problem. A lot of states have gone to independent commissions. In California, in Arizona, many other states have asked for citizens to step forward and be part of the map-making process. There is something called the Fair Representation Act that Congressman Don Beyer of Virginia has proposed that would involve kind of moving our single-member system towards a multi-member districts that are represented by more people, larger districts. So there are lots of, you know, clever ways of doing this right now. There are computer algorithms that can show you when a map is so infected with partisan bias as to be, you know, an outlier and way too extreme.
Wait, David, but I want to stop you right there. You just said there are algorithms that can prove this. So I'm trying to understand here the hesitation on the part of at least the conservative judges on the court to assume at this point, a moral responsibility to ensure that Republicans or Democrats or Americans more generally are able to cast their votes fairly. I'm just not sure if they have the technology. Why won't they see this as a moral imperative at this point?
The technology is so clear on this point right now. I mean, in the North Carolina case, you can run computer algorithms that show that the maps that the Republicans there produced are a 0.3 outlier. So if you were to do tens of thousands of maps, you would only find something as bad as what the Republicans came up with, a 10-3 outcome in something like 100 out of, you know, 25,000 outcomes. We can tell that this is not fair, that the problem is convincing these justices that this math is real. In previous cases, Chief Justice Roberts has referred to these computer algorithms and formulas as sociological gobbledygook and said that they rise above his educational background. Well, I mean, he's a Harvard graduate, a Harvard law graduate. I think he's, you know, capable of understanding, you know, basic outlier ratios here.
But isn't the beautiful thing about math that it actually has a finite outcome?
I think that's absolutely right.
Is there any recourse here for something known as disparate impact? These gerrymandering laws and maps are really impacting communities of color, from what I understand. So is that an argument that can move this forward?
There's two separate sets of case law here. There's the racial gerrymandering case law and the partisan gerrymandering case law. And the problem here is that it's all coming together now. In the past, the courts have said that you cannot do a racial gerrymander. And this is what happened exactly in North Carolina. They said, we are doing a partisan gerrymander because the courts had already thrown out their racial gerrymander, when in fact they were using the exact same political data to draw these lines for the partisan gerrymander as they had on the maps that were deemed to be a racial gerrymander. So if the courts can't step forward and find a solution here, what we're going to see are racial gerrymanders masquerading as partisan gerrymanders. These algorithms are so precise, and the amount of information that mapmakers have about us is just so exact that folks can go surgically down one side of a street and back another with a clear understanding of how all of us vote. And as we head towards 2020 and the next redistricting cycle, this problem is only going to get worse if the Supreme Court doesn't step in and find a moral solution to this intense political problem.
I mean, the issue here is that the precision, I believe it was called surgical precision, with which, in the case of North Carolina, these maps were redrawn to disproportionately impact black voters and voters of color. So it's stunning to me that we're still trying to figure out a mathematical equation. Want to move this forward a little bit here, David. We are just a short time away from redistricting for the entire congressional map after this little thing called the 2020 census, which is also experiencing its own controversy, if you will. What's the process like behind that redistricting?
It is different in every state. And what the Republicans understood so intelligently in 2010 and what the Democrats fell asleep on is that in most states, it is state legislatures that draw the lines, sometimes with input from the governor. So Republicans were able to capture in the 2010 election complete control of the redistricting process in states like Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin. And that's why we're in the place we are right now. If you look at all of the cases that are making their way through litigation right now, it all stems from Republicans capturing complete control of this process back in 2010. Democrats have to understand that if they cannot win back key state legislative chambers in these states or win governor's offices that hold veto power over these maps, we will be talking about partisan gerrymandering for a long time to come. And if there's not a positive outcome out of the Supreme Court on these cases, if by some chance they do say that partisan gerrymandering is non-justiciable and beyond the ability of the court to determine, we could be looking at a serious problem of anti-majoritarian rule for another decade.
David Daley is the author of Rat Why Your Vote Doesn't Count. David, thanks again.
A pleasure.
It's been 9 years since the Affordable Care Act was passed into law. And for 9 years, Republicans have been vowing to repeal the ACA. This week, the Department of Justice announced that it supports fully overturning the Affordable Care Act, siding with a district court ruling from December that says the ACA is unconstitutional. Despite that, however, President Trump had this to say on Tuesday.
Let me just tell you exactly what my message is. The Republican Party will soon be known as the Party of Healthcare. You watch.
Meanwhile, Democrats were set to roll out legislation to build upon the Affordable Care Act, aiming to lower costs and increase coverage. Speaker Pelosi, announcing this legislation at a press conference, responded to the DOJ move.
I always think of Mr. Clyburn and John Lewis when they quote Martin Luther King, when he talks about, of all the injustices, the most inhumane is the inequality of health care. And the Department of Justice becomes the Department of Injustice when it wants to tear down health care benefits.
Well, what does all this mean for the future of the ACA? We have Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Mary Agnes, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So lots going on this week. Tell us more. Remind us about this decision that the Trump administration is supporting. What exactly did it say?
It's extraordinary. What happened is that a court judge in December sided with Republican attorneys general who said that the Affordable Care Act was no longer constitutional because Congress had removed a financial penalty for people that, if you don't have health insurance, you'd have to pay that penalty. When they removed it, they said the entire law should be struck down. Now, at the time, the administration didn't go that far. They simply said, if there isn't a requirement that people buy health insurance, that insurers are not required to cover everybody with a pre-existing medical condition, but they wanted the rest of the law to stand. As we know, late Monday, the administration said, we agree with those Republican attorneys general and the lower court ruling that the entire law should be thrown out. So I think this was a big surprise for a lot of Republicans to see this.
So if the ACA were to be completely nullified, Mary Agnes, what would happen exactly and how would that work? It just feels like it could be a big mess.
I think a big mess is the perfect way to describe it. You have 20 million people who have gained coverage through the Affordable Care Act, whether it is receiving a subsidy to purchase insurance on the federal and the state exchanges, whether it is millions of people who've gotten their coverage through the Medicaid expansion, or for even Americans who get their coverage at work, knowing no lifetime caps on coverage, no annual caps on coverage, being able to receive preventive care without a payment out of your pocket, and also knowing that you're covered even if you have a pre-existing medical condition. The ramifications of this would go far beyond people on the Medicaid expansion or the people who've gotten insurance in the exchanges. So we really have to think about that. The ACA is kind of baked into our healthcare system now, and unraveling this would be a mess.
This feels, again, very political, Mary Agnes, but we did hear the president say that the Republican Party will soon be known as the party of healthcare. What does that mean? I mean, is the Trump administration trying to adopt a policy that would compare to the ACA ahead of 2020?
I think they're trying to put a fire under Republicans on Capitol Hill that have been unable to come to a consensus plan to replace the Affordable Care Act and then put that plan into law. That has been a big problem. What's been happening is, in lieu of a Republican replacement for the Affordable Care Act, the Trump administration has been making a lot of new regulations, administrative moves under presidential power to try to say to states that ask permission to offer less substandard plans that the Affordable Care Act has, less comprehensive plans, to give them permission to go forward. So the administration will stay, if you will, on that administrative track. But yesterday on the Hill, I think the president was trying to put a fire under Republicans saying, we ran on repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. We've got to get the job done. We've got to do it for the voters. And this is a rallying cry for him.
What about Congress? I mean, yesterday there was news of new legislation that the Democrats are trying to roll out. What's their proposal?
Their proposal is to look at the Affordable Care Act and to expand upon it, to make subsidies more generous for people that want to purchase coverage, to make sure that all of those things in the Affordable Care Act, protection of pre-existing conditions, making sure your kids can stay on health insurance until age 26 remain. They want to restore funding in the law for outreach and enrollment. Every time we have an enrollment season, the advertising budget has been cut by the Trump administration, the on-the-ground assisters who help you through the process, all those things have been cut. So they want to strengthen the Affordable Care Act. And this decision by the administration Monday night was really a gift to Democrats who wanted to refocus the political message on health care because the Mueller report didn't really deliver what they had expected. So they have focused on this. They had a big press conference yesterday. Health care, as we know, was a huge issue in the 2018 midterms, and Democrats want to jump on that for 2020.
Let's talk about the people who might actually be affected by this, Americans, everyday Americans who need health care. What have you gotten a sense, Mary Agnes, of what the temperature is, if you will, no pun intended there, about how Americans feel about the Affordable Care Act, whether they want to see changes and whether they would support a Republican plan going forward?
Polling has consistently shown that Americans prefer building upon the Affordable Care Act and not repealing it. Its favorable rating has grown since its inaction 9 years ago. It's now hit higher than the 50% mark. And people like, especially when you do polling on individual provisions, they really like them. For example, can I keep my adult kid up to 26 on my health insurance plan? People love that. People like the idea of no matter what your medical status that you that the insurer has to sell you insurance to cover that.
And Mary Agnes, let me ask you really quickly before we...
Sure.
Are we talking about across the political spectrum, people are happy? The folks that you're saying people like that, these are people
yes,
who are across
I
the political... That's an important point.
Yeah. Yeah, Democrats and independents have the highest numbers on those, but Republicans are right behind them. Republicans have never liked the individual mandate, the requirement that you must purchase health insurance. But now the fine, the monetary fine, is gone. So in effect, the individual mandate isn't there. But no, across the political parties, people love the individual provisions.
Mary Agnes Carey is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thanks for being with us, Mary Agnes.
Thank you.
This weekend, more than 150 people were killed in a raid of the Ogasagu village in the Mopti region in Mali. It's the latest in a series of attacks between two ethnic groups, the Dogon and the Fulani. But Saturday's mass murder of the Fulani was an escalation in the violence. The International Criminal Court is now investigating. Corinne Dufka is the West Africa Director at Human Rights Watch and lead investigator for the Sahel region, and she joins us now. Corinne, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
What have you heard from those who have been impacted?
Well, we've just started investigating this incident, which, as you rightly mentioned, is the latest in a cascade of such violent incidents in central Mali. I had a researcher at the hospital yesterday interviewing women who were telling harrowing tales of their children being ripped from their arms and killed. There was another woman who had been killed, dumped in a well, and left for dead. Others who described children being put in a house to try to protect them and that house being put on fire. So we're just beginning our investigation into this horrific incident, and we are also pushing the Malian authorities to investigate and hold those responsible accountable.
Corinne, first of all, I want to just be clear. Were the majority of the victims here women and children?
We're not sure about the majority, but there were numerous women and children among the victims, that is for sure.
And who are the ethnic groups that are involved in this, for those of us who might not be following the story as closely?
The key ethnic groups are the Dogon, who are largely cultivators, and then the Fulani, or Pul, as they're known in West Africa, who are herders.
And can you describe what's at the heart of the tensions between these two groups?
There are a number of issues which are underscoring this rapid deterioration in security and increase in violence. First, there are longstanding tensions over access or water. But over the centuries, the elders from these groups have been able to achieve peace within the villagers. But since 2015, the armed Islamists who have been active in the Sahel region, coming down from Algeria earlier on, have been pushing into central Mali and further south into Burkina Faso. And they have concentrated their recruitment effort on the Fulani. And indeed, many of the Fulani have joined them. And so as that has happened, Dogon village defense forces have turned into offensive operations to try to address the expanding presence of these groups. Now, also underscoring the violence is the very sparse presence of the Malian security forces, who are simply not there and often don't act neutrally and impartially in responding to the jihadist presence.
Has any group claimed responsibility for the massacre, at least officially?
No, they have not, but the massacre is very similar to numerous other massacres that I have documented during 2018 and then also this year in 2019.
How does this fit into, Corinne, the broader context of human rights violations in the country, in Mali?
Well, Mali went through a spectacular meltdown in 2012, where you had a coup d'etat in the south, and then the entire north of the country was taken over by Tuareg separatists and armed Islamist groups allied to Al-Qaeda. Since then, the French forces in the region helped disperse a large number of those Islamists, but instead, from 2015, they started moving south into central Mali, and then, as I mentioned, further down into the region. Rule of law is very weak in Mali. The security forces, the often abusive security forces, engage in very serious abuses in the context of counterterrorism operation. That also drives people into the hands of the Islamists. On top of that, the judiciary is very weak. And it's important to note that individuals from both sides, both the Dogon civilians and Pul civilians, have suffered from very serious abuses in the context of this tit-for-tat violence. And the Malian judiciary has failed to come down down on either side hard enough. And so, you know, the message to perpetrators has been that they can continue to take security into their own hands. So, you know, we're really hoping what with the pressure from the international community, the coverage from people, including yourselves, the presence of the ICC will help push the Malians to finally make good on their promises to impartially protect their population and to ensure justice for what are horrible crimes.
Corinne Dufka is the West Africa Director of Human Rights Watch. Corinne, thanks again.
Thank you.
What does it mean to survive gun violence in the United States?
It was the first time since graduating Columbine that I'd had to experience a fire drill. I had this full-blown PTSD episode, tears streaming down my face, frozen, shaking, you know, the whole bit. And my teacher came and she was like, "What is going on?" And I was like, "I have PTSD. I can't do this today. I gotta go."
I could not finish high school because I would get so anxious in school, being in a classroom with all those people. I had to drop out and get my GED because I just had so much anxiety.
I seen regular guns outside in the communities, in like a sewer. I look downward and all I see is I think it was a handgun. I forgot. I think it was a 45. And I also seen a knife with it, and I was like, wow. And that's when I was 8.
You were 8 and you were seeing guns in the street.
8, 9, and it kept getting older.
My 8th grade year, I was 13. My dad got shot multiple times just sitting outside.
People want you to get over it. You know, I wasn't shot. I'm not in a wheelchair or anything like that. And so...
neither was I.
Yeah, so it's, you know, people say just, you know, move along.
We have people dying every day in our face, our own classmates. We can't go outside past a certain time. You can't do this, you can't do that, because you're scared of dying from a gun or something like that.
Those are survivors of mass shootings and people who experience gun violence in their communities every day, talking to The Takeaway about their trauma. Since last week, 2 Parkland students who survived the mass shooting just over a year ago died of apparent suicide. And this week, the father of one of the young victims of the Sandy Hook attack also killed himself. Many factors are at play in any suicide, and it can be hard to draw direct lines between something like the Parkland attacks and the suicides of survivors. But one thing is certain. Witnessing gun violence, either once on a mass scale or through continued exposure, has an impact on a person's mental health. And the risks of this kind of trauma feel especially acute when we're talking about children and teens. Maurice Richards is a psychology professor at Loyola University Chicago who studies the effects of community violence on adolescents. And Sandro Galea is the dean of the Boston University School of Public Health. And he starts by describing the impact a mass shooting can have on people's mental health.
To my mind, the way to think about these events is, in some respects, in concentric circles. So first of all, when we have these terrible tragedies, you have the people who are directly, who are killed, or then people who are injured. So you have that group of people who are really at the highest risk of having mental health problems after these events. Then you have their family and loved ones. And then you have the community at large, which is the people around them. And we know that from a point of view of mental health problems after trauma, and we know this from trauma in general, but it's reasonable to assume that it applies to guns and gun violence, that the people who are injured are the ones who are most likely to have mental health consequences. Then you have their family and loved ones, and again, you have the general community.
And Sandra, just want to follow up on that. Is it possible to draw any connections between, for example, the Parkland attack and the 2 suicides we've seen by survivors recently?
Yeah, I think we have to be careful about drawing too much from individual events. Two suicides are obviously deeply sad, but we have to be careful statistically. But having said that, the observation that after gun violence, you have a high prevalence of mental illness among those who are affected is fairly straightforward. The observation that mental illness is one of the biggest risk factors for subsequent suicide is fairly straightforward. So the fact that we are seeing suicides in people who are affected by these events really, I think, appropriately draws our attention to these events and should serve as a wake-up call to all of us to recognize that mental health is a problem that we seldom discuss about mass shootings and shootings in general. It's something that should rise to our consciousness. So thank you for bringing this conversation up.
You're welcome. We think it's a very important one to begin and to continue. Maurice, I want to bring you in here because over the summer, our team went down to Miami and talked to young Black children in a community that had been deeply affected by gun violence. And this is a community that is different from what we think about when we think about surviving mass shootings. Can you tell us, Maurice, what the experience is of teenagers that you work with who have repeated exposure to gun violence in their communities?
Yes, it is similar and in some ways different. So one of the important differences is that kids living in very low income, very high crime communities experience repeated exposure to violence. And so it has somewhat different effects because of that. And also they live in the context of this high poverty and high crime, sometimes deep poverty, which creates a whole other set of difficulties for the kids and their families. You know, they experience stresses to do with, you know, fear of evictions, possible homelessness. Definitely most of the kids I work with experience some form of hunger and poor quality schools. Just some examples of the context within which they live.
And Maurice, I'm wondering if you could even expand on that a little bit. I mean, I grew up in public housing. I'm a woman of color. I understand some of these issues. But for the broader audience here, let's talk a little bit about those stresses. You're describing things that are chronic stressors, lack of food, lack of stability, you know, on top of witnessing gun violence, right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. And it creates larger challenges for kids to be effective in school, to be effective as kids. They often don't have places to play that are safe. And when you're hungry and you're living in some form of fear, it's hard to pay attention and to do well in school. So there's a constant kind of level of interference with their functioning and their sense of, you know, just being able to relax and enjoy life. The other thing is that kids growing up in this kind of dense poverty often, most times, do not have access to mental health services. So they don't have access to treatment or therapy to help them manage and deal with the mental health problems that they're experiencing. And then the other piece is that they have ready access to guns. So not only do they lack access to the services, but they also have access to firearms, which creates more difficulties for them.
We have Maurice Richards with us. She's a psychology professor at Loyola University Chicago who studies the effects of community violence on adolescents. And Sandro Galea is the dean of the Boston University School of Public Health. Maurice, let's talk about solutions. Are there best practices to help children who are exposed to gun violence in their communities, particularly talking about Black and brown, low-income children who are facing a variety of stressors, not just gun violence?
Yeah, so we know that families are very important to kids, obviously. So when the work I've done and many others have done is we find that when families are supportive of kids, that they demonstrate warmth, that parents are able to listen and show concern and care about the feelings of kids, that kids do better. When kids feel connected with their parents, when they spend more time with their families and they feel close to their mothers and fathers, the outcomes are better. The mental health is better, even when they're exposed to high levels of community violence. So families are really important, obviously. But the other thing is that we find that neighborhoods, when neighborhoods are more cohesive, in other words, neighbors look out for each other, they look out for the kids in the neighborhood, they're safe places for kids to play, that helps kids to do better in life. And then there's schools where teachers understand trauma. When teachers and administrators are trauma-informed, kids are more supported within those contexts. And, you know, obviously kids spend lots of time in school. So those are important elements. And we just need more services and programs for these kids. Many of these schools have limited social workers and counselors available, and kids need access, especially kids who have been experienced trauma. They need access to those kind of services. And the services really need to be in the schools. Kids are not able to cross gang lines. Thus, they cannot go to other places, even within their neighborhoods, if it's across a gang line. And parents can't attend services if they're not immediately accessible. And again, schools are really best places for those kinds of programs.
Sandro, why don't we see this as a public health crisis? If mass shootings and community violence, both of these types of violence, are having such an impact on particularly young people's mental health, why have we stopped short of calling this a public health crisis?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think the answer to that is that some of us have not stopped short of calling it a public health crisis. It is a public health crisis. We can start with firearms themselves, to paraphrase the former Surgeon General Satcher, who said, well, if it's not a health issue, why are so many people dying from it? That by definition makes it a health issue. That's on the guns themselves. Mental health, we have historically not treated mental health as equal to physical health, which of course is baffling because mental illness is as disabling and in many cases more and more disabling for a longer period of time than is physical health. So we should think of mental health as a public health crisis, particularly after traumatic events. And if I may underscore that something that Marie said, hopefully this is applicable to all listeners because we are talking about disadvantaged children. But the core of the message that Maurice was giving about the importance of social isolation is true, whether it is underprivileged kids or any kid or any adult who experiences traumatic events. If I were to say, what is the one risk factor that we should avoid? It's social isolation. We know that social supports in the immediate surroundings of the person who has experienced a traumatic event, or social cohesion, again, as Maurice said, in the community, are immensely protective for the mental health consequences of these events. So that, I think, puts a premium on us to make sure that we create environments where we have those supports for people who experience these events. And to create those environments, we need to have the conversation, which is why I'm very grateful to you for having the conversation, and be clear that this is a health concern and we should create the supports to listen to it and to deal with it.
And this is probably going to sound a little bit pie in the sky, Sandra, so forgive me for this, but we are here, and Maurice, we are here talking about issues like social isolation and really dealing with the response to mass shootings and gun violence. What about the prevention here? I mean, what about going as far back as that? Is there the potential for mental health services starting from the beginning so we can avoid these types of issues? Or is that just not even feasible at this point?
I don't think it's pie in the sky at all. I think it's aspirational. It's exactly the kind of aspiration we should have. And the question becomes, how do we create that? And I think we create it in two ways relevant to this conversation. Number one is we need to understand that mental health, more than other forms of health, are deeply responsive to social and economic conditions. If we want to improve population mental health, what we need to do is create a society that generates health. That means stable social supports, that means cohesive neighborhoods, that means healthy places where people eat, live, work, and play. That ultimately is deeply protective against mental illness and protects people when unexpected stressors like traumatic events happens. That's number one. And the second thing is, we need to shift the national conversation to recognize that traumatic events are public health issues, that mental health is an important public health concern. Because when we do that, when the conversation shifts, it creates the space for creative solutions. And I worry that the fact that we have not had this conversation as much as we should be having has hampered our collective capacity to come up with creative solutions.
Maurice, what would it change for victims and survivors if we treated gun violence like a public health issue in this country, particularly for the communities that you work with?
Well, I think that one of the things that is desperately needed is improved communities for kids to live in. So I think that when investments are made in communities, long-term investments, schools are really improved. Financing of schools is muchly improved. And families are fully supported in their efforts to raise kids in a healthy way, that you see changes. You see real improvements for the kids. So I think investments in the community is extremely important. We've worked in the South Side and West Side of Chicago for many years, and poverty is a huge public health concern.
And listeners, if you or someone around you needs help, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. Maurice Richards is a psychology professor at Loyola University Chicago. Maurice, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
And Sandro Galea is the dean of the BU School of Public Health. His forthcoming book is called Well, What We Need to Talk About When We Talk About Health. Sandro, thanks to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Finally today, a note about Jeremy Richmond. Jeremy was the father of 6-year-old Aviel Rose, one of the children killed in the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. Shortly after Aviel's murder, Jeremy founded the Aviel Foundation to focus on research into violence and the brain. Last year, I spoke to Jeremy about his work after the mass shooting in Parkland.
You know, coping is a, it's a relative term. I mean, it's an infinite feeling of just brutal loss. There's a part of you missing. And immediately, my wife and I, in a hazy 48 hours, decided that we were going to do something. We were going to take action. And wanted to play to our strengths. Both being scientists, we decided to approach violence from a scientific perspective and study violence as the disease that it is, coming from this organ that we know very little about, the brain, and created the foundation. And that helped a lot because it gave us a purpose, a reason, a focus, and that helped a lot.
On Monday, Jeremy was found dead in an apparent suicide. Remember that if you or someone you know is struggling, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.